All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting today, September 20, 2023, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, at the United States Courthouse. We're appreciative of those who made it possible for us to be here today and accommodated us so well. Of course, our thanks to them, and we welcome you in here to hear this argument. This case is an appeal brought by Midtown Ventures in a case called Midtown Ventures v. Capone, case number 49679. In this matter, the appellant is represented by John Magnuson and responded by Megan O'Dowd. Counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters before arguing today?
I do not.
No, Your Honor.
Very well. You may proceed, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is John Magnuson. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant Midtown Ventures. I'm here today with Mr. Butler, who is, for all intents and purposes, Midtown Ventures, seated over on my left behind me. I recognize that the court, as is usual, has had an opportunity to look over all of the briefing and the submissions. So, we have limited time. You don't want to hear me repeat all the facts that I know you've read three times now, at least, nor the procedural background. I'd like to take the opportunity today to just focus on what I think are the two germane issues. One is, do we have an enforceable agreement? And by agreement, I'm talking about the 2008 agreement for pardon. Because we don't have an enforceable agreement, we don't really have a lot more to talk about today, other than the propriety of the district court's award of attorney's fees, which would still be an issue. But I submit to you that the 2008 agreement is an enforceable agreement. It's been characterized as some intention, expression of a maybe, could be, someday. It's not. I would like to go through that agreement with some particular specificity to show why I respectfully submit that this is an enforceable agreement. First of all, it's entitled agreement on all capital letters. It's referred to on page 1 and 3 instances as an agreement. It's referred to on page 2 and 4 instances as an agreement. Page 3, it's only 3 pages, just as signatures. It includes the Capone signature. It identifies the Capone's property with specificity with an actual copy of the legal description. It identifies what we call the Midtown Ventures property, formerly the housing company, formerly the Idaho Youth Ranch property. We'll call it Midtown Ventures property. It identifies that with specificity. It clearly says that, and then another one of these acronyms that because of the passage of time, we refer to it by three things. It was a Lake City Development Corporation, the Urban Renewal District, that became Ignite, but we just kind of call it the Urban Renewal Agency, and that covers it all. But the Urban Renewal Agency will, according to the agreement, upon execution, buy property for alternative parking to be used by the Capones as substitute parking under their easement that allows non-exclusive nighttime parking. When the Urban Renewal District purchases and improves the property, and I quote, the Capones will execute more complete documents evidencing the relocation, quote. The Capones further agreed to, quote, execute and deliver any and all future deeds and assurances reasonably required to carry out the transaction, quote. Was this agreement once performed enforceable by the housing company? I haven't heard any argument that the housing company couldn't have enforced this agreement, yet it is posited that nonetheless the agreement is unenforceable by Midtown based upon some identified deficiencies.
Mr. Manson, I understood the district court's comments and maybe some of the briefing to be on the other side that this whole concept was abandoned, not that the agreement was ever completed, that there was no interest or lack of interest in the community to develop this housing as contemplated under the agreement, and the process was abandoned, to use that word. What's your response to that?
Well, I appreciate that. I was going to touch on that, but we'll jump into that. The district court did make that conclusion, and I would submit that the district court's conclusion is erroneous for several reasons. Number one, what was the basis for the district court's conclusion that the project had been abandoned? The district court's basis was evidence introduced by the Capones through the declaration of Teresa Capone and through the declaration of counsel, Ms. O'Dowd, both of which included material that was specifically objected to by Midtown Ventures on the basis of hearsay. This information included recitations from Mrs. Capone as to conversations she had with identified and unidentified people at the City of Coeur d'Alene. It included statements attributed to the Urban Renewal District from documents not really attached to Ms. O'Dowd's declaration, but, you know, redacted, extracted, and then put in. So the objection was made, and the objection, which we've also raised the issue of propriety of the evidentiary ruling, these were pure hearsay. And the city, if this is not an admission by an agent of a party opponent, because the city, and this is my answer to your question, but it gets to another part of the argument. Why was this not abandoned? Why was the district court wrong? This evidence was inadmissible because there is no hearsay exception for statements by the city, because the city, although named in this caption, and it still shows up on the caption today, has never been served, it's never appeared. And the Urban Renewal District was dismissed from this litigation by the Capones prior to the hearing on the summary judgment motion. So I objected to this, and the district court, I just say, just missed it and was completely wrong on the evidentiary rule. But even if that doesn't carry the day, I submit that it should. That this is an agreement. You read the agreement. The agreement does not define a project. The agreement defines a use, and that use is workforce housing and retail. And in fact, there is no evidence of any specific project in any specific format that was prepared, discussed, conveyed through any admissible evidence or otherwise that would have formed some exclusive basis for proceeding under the agreement.
Well, it was more than that, wasn't it? When I look at the 2008 agreement, it says, whereas the youth ranch, the LCDC, and THC are assembling property and preparing for development, the development, and then it talks about property for workforce housing and retail development. So there's purpose stated there, but there's also a reference to a specific group that's working together to make that happen. And so why isn't it clear just from the face of this agreement and the fact that the youth ranch ended up selling, the THC ended up selling the property to Midtown, but that development didn't happen?
If that was then, I recognize that you asked the questions today, but I rhetorically ask if that was indeed all we needed to look at and the case was over, we would not have a provision that says this agreement shall be binding upon it in years to the benefit of the parties, respective heirs, successors, and assigns. Clearly envisioning that these are not the only parties who can develop this property for the specified use.
Well, we're going to look to the boilerplate, though, right below that. It says time is of the essence of this agreement. Earlier in the agreement, it says the parties are going to work towards more complete documents evidencing the relocation as soon as possible. If time was of the essence of the project, and it was supposed to be done as soon as possible, and 10 years go by or more with nothing happening, how can we draw any other conclusion than this was abandoned?
Well, and I'm not being glib, there was something that happened after the agreement was executed and before the project was completed, and that was the son of the Great Depression, otherwise known as the Great Recession, where everything stopped. And this was supported in the record, but...
Well, that might explain a year or two, maybe three. But we're talking, we're in 2020 now, and none of this got consummated the way the party envisioned it.
Well, I think what you're proposing is what has been raised as is an issue not passed upon by the district court. I don't know that that goes towards enforceability so much as opposed to somebody's defense that this has been waived, or latches, or a statute of limitations. It doesn't relate to the enforceability of the agreement itself.
What about all the blanks in the agreement? I counted at least 8 blanks. My experience in contract law as an attorney was whenever there was a blank, you had all of the parties initial it. None of these blanks, some of them weren't filled in, but the ones that were filled in are initial. What are we to draw from that?
I don't count 8 blanks. I see most of them completed, but for example,
well, for the one I'm referring to is the very first one, the question mark after Roosevelt Avenue, and I realize that may be different than the other blanks.
No, and I can certainly address those. We have, for example, one of the defenses posited by the proponents is that we have an insufficient legal description for the alternative.
I think you're misperceiving my question. I don't doubt that they were filled in. I'm just wondering why they weren't initial. Every time my father sold a home, for example, anytime there's a blank to fill in, those blanks need to be acknowledged separately by all the parties, don't they?
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. The blanks are not questioned by the proponents. So the proponents do not dispute the fact that this agreement in the form before the court, with the blanks completed in, as you find them, is in fact the agreement.
What about the reference to costs where it says it is agreed that, and it says THC question mark will cover all the costs? That sure doesn't look like a technical agreement to me.
And in that regard, there's two points. One, who will cover the cost of drafting the document to relocate the easement once the Urban Renewal District purchases the property and it's ready for parking? Who will do that? It says THC question mark. Is it a material shortcoming in the contract that the proponents presumably argue that they want to pay for that?
What I'm saying is that it suggests there wasn't a final meeting of the minds. This was looked, in all respects, as more of a draft. When you see statements with question marks as an X.
And with all due respect, when you posit this looks like a draft, you know, it looks like what it looks like. I wasn't there. Opposing counsel wasn't there. These are the cards we're dealt. But if it's a draft, I rhetorically ask, then why does everybody sign it and everybody agree that they'll do the extra document necessary to complete it? And I say, if it's a draft, what part of it, with these blanks filled in an unchallenged format, what part of it is not enforceable? Because obviously district court found it unenforceable. Why are we here? What part of it renders it unenforceable? Is it unenforceable because there's a question mark after who's going to pay the cost of drafting the relocated easement? I suggest it's not unenforceable on that basis.
Mr. Banks, frankly, to me, more concerning is whether this was 400 feet or 400 yards from the restaurant. That's still left undecided in this agreement, and I'm unclear. Was it yards? There's some talking and reading that, well, a couple of the lots are under 400 feet, a couple weren't. What did the parties agree on?
And if you said everyone signed, then it doesn't look like the city of Portland signed.
So, well, we have two issues there. We have the 400 yards versus feet, and we have the city's signature. So if I could address the 400 yards versus feet, yes, it says 400 yards versus feet. So do we know which one of those the Capones agreed to? We don't know that. But we do know that they at least agreed to one of them, and the most restrictive one is 400 feet. And we also know that when they identify the lots that are then believed to be the location of the proposed parking, we know what those lots are, and we know, for example, lot 21, a according to the declaration of Drew Dittman, is 400, and I believe 407 or 409. It's in the record. I might be off by two, but that is 400, let's call it 407. 407 away, and it's specifically acknowledged to be a lot that is capable of providing the substitute parking. So, yes, yards versus feet, but does that render it unenforceable if we know there was an agreement to one of them, and we'll take the most restrictive? The city's signature was an issue before the district court. That was also argued by the Capones. And the agreement, and interestingly, the agreement's genesis was, as the court gleaned from the record, the agreement's genesis was the fact that the Capones were expanding and need additional parking to meet the city parking requirements. Capones have since met those requirements, but the lots that are designated, the sufficiency of the legal description that was posited is it, one of the blanks, Justice Mueller, was blank addition. It says lots 5, 6, 2021, or what, 5, 6, yes, 5, 6, 2021, lot 6, blank addition. And to that I respond that this court has held in the case a couple years ago, the Tricor v. Stockton and Brinkmeyer case, that if a extrinsic evidence is admissible for the purpose of identifying the land described and applying the description to the property, we know from what is in this agreement, we know that there is an addition within 400 feet, going with the minimum 400 feet. We know there's an addition in the northwest corner of the intersection of Roosevelt and 4th Street that has lots numbered 5, 6, 20, and 21 in a block 6. That constellation of possibilities is reduced to exactly one, which was supported by the declaration of Mr. Dittman. It was reduced to exactly one without any objection to the admissibility of Mr. Dittman's declaration to show that within 400 feet of the Capone's restaurant, the only addition is Russell's addition, the only recorded flat with lot 5, 6, 2021 of the block 6.
But within the last year, we issued two different decisions that talked about Tricor, but also said we're not going to look to extrinsic evidence to determine the legal description of the property unless the document specifically incorporates the extrinsic evidence. And so the fact you might be able to look at something and say, oh, this is most likely the addition that they intended to include, unless that document is specifically written and incorporated into the agreement, we don't look outside the four corners of this agreement. So we're struggling with how this legal description is adequate or enforceable.
Well, it's lots 5, 6, 20, and 21, block 6 of an addition.
Right, and I can't tell what that addition is unless I get out a plat map or a tax map of Midtown and I start going through and saying, all right, and that's exactly what we said in the last year we're not going to do. So I'm struggling with the argument that we can rely on Tricor because I think we've given more contours to Tricor, more explanation for how that applies.
This court has held in the past, I recognize that there are cases, and the funny thing about the practice of law is that one can usually find a case that supports, generally speaking, whatever one wants to posit. And there are cases that support the proposition that we can supply a legal description when we use a street address because we know what the property is.
Well, cases, though, aren't like expert witnesses that you can hire one to say what you want them to. Aren't cases supposed to be reflections of law and have some permanency? And wouldn't the most recent cases, then, be the most indicative of what we stand on?
One can't argue with what this court said yesterday is obviously going to take precedence over what it said 10 years ago. I mean, that's the society and the system we live in. But there can be, there was no objection interposed to the evidence offered. So, you know, your question, Justice Zahn, is that if we were in a trial and we were litigating this issue, and the question is, what is that blank? Is it Russell's addition, the only one it can be? And the evidence is offered that this is Russell's addition, and no one objects. The evidence is received. The evidence is in the record. There is no objection.
But I'm saying, regardless of what evidence is in the record, we've said the law is, you determine whether the legal description is adequate according to the four corners of the document. That's all you look at, unless the document incorporates another reference document. And so, regardless of whether the evidence is in the record or not, when we talk about whether the 2008 agreement is enforceable and whether the legal description is adequate, I'm struggling with the idea that we can look outside the four corners of this agreement to create an adequate legal description, because I think we've expressly said you can't.
And I respectfully submit it's not creating the legal description. The legal description, it's referencing the lots, the block, and an addition, which is a plat. It left out the name of the plat. It has a legal description. The legal description is not provided by supplementation. The legal description is clarified with a missing term. It's not being provided. It's being supplemented, where clearly the parties had an agreement. Certainly that's our position. They had an agreement. They signed it with a legal description that was incomplete, but not in and of itself so lacking as to be insufficient. Lot 5-6-2021 of an addition, a capital A addition, created by a plat with a blank, because obviously, at the time they did it, I can't presume that, but it appears that they did not remember or know what the name of the addition was. But they knew it was in the northwest corner of the intersection of Roosevelt and 4th Street, within 400 feet.
Does the fact that the description that you're talking about right now appears in the recitals and not the contractual language itself matter?
Well, and the answer to your question is, I don't think that makes a distinction, because if that makes a distinction, then the district court erred by finding that this particular agreement was limited to workforce housing and retail development, because that's not in the body of the agreement either, nor is there an incorporation of the recitals. So, to be consistent with, I'm consistent that this recitals is part of the agreement, because we also have the workforce housing and retail development, and certainly we're not challenging that you know, was offered by the proponents for the purpose of the agreement, and we agree with that.
I mean, the interesting thing about this agreement is if you look at the operative language in paragraph one, it's just that the parking provision will be relocated to property within 400 yards feet of proponent's property on the LCD property, and then you're going to have more documents to come. I mean, that to me is the operative language, and the question is that a sufficiently specific set of is that sufficiently specific to constitute an agreement?
As this is written, the Urban Renewal District LCDC ignites that have purchased alternative parking within four, ignoring the chief's question about yards and feet, of going with feet. The Urban Renewal Agency could have purchased alternative parking within 400 feet of the Capone's, irrespective of lots 5-6-2021, which was expected to be, and it would have satisfied obligation under this agreement. And then there would have been an obligation on the part of the Capone's to amend the 1999 easement to move their parking easement over to that property. So to answer your question, it's not specific to that property, but that's what it ended up being.
If that paragraph number one is the offer's paragraph, it actually states four intentions in that paragraph, at least. It states that the parties will work towards execution of more complete documents, that one of the parties intends to do something, another party intends to do something, and another party intends to do something. Why isn't this just not best seen as an agreement to agree?
I disagree that this is just some expression of intent. I will say that for this. I mean, it says intent, but I mean that in the context of, is this an enforceable agreement or an expression of something that we hope will come to fruition? Once this agreement is signed, it's clearly envisioned that the Urban Renewal District is going to rely on this and go out and purchase property to be used for alternative parking arrangements for the homes. It's also intended that the housing company, which didn't then own the IOU branch, is, based upon this agreement, going to go buy the IOU branch property, and because it's not otherwise utilizable for the purposes of workforce housing and retail development, because it's got nighttime non-exclusive proposed parking. So it's saying, you sign this, I am going to do this, and the I am going to do this is buy new parking, buy this property, move the parking easement, and proceed with retail and workforce housing.
So what's the effect of a document that says all of these actions and purchases are intended and they never come to fruition? It strikes me that you don't have anything.
Well, I disagree, Justice Stegner, that they didn't come to fruition. The Urban Renewal Agency bought the property, improved it for parking. The housing company bought the property. The project was authorized for workforce housing and retail and has not proceeded. It has not proceeded, despite the best efforts of my client as a successor to THC in title, because we can't proceed with the project with the components asserting they have the right to park on it, not performing in accordance with the agreement as we allege. So, as Warren Hardy said, it's a fine kettle of fish. I'm sorry.
You're the first to go up
actually. Counsel, look, I recognize you didn't draft this. Opposing counsel didn't draft this. I expect both of you would have done a better job than this.
I hope so.
The very last statement in the agreement says that this agreement is entered into on the date first above stated. The first paragraph, the date is left blank.
Yeah, and the record did not fill in that date other than the record supplied the footer of the document 52208. It also has...
That's just the date it was printed.
That was the date it was printed, but we also know from the record that after this agreement was signed in the first week of June of 2008, the Urban Renewal District did in fact purchase lots 5, 6, 21, and 22 of block 6 of Russell's Edition.
I agree that there's some potential estoppel issues here, but just on its own face, it's just frustrating to see an agreement. None of the signatures are dated. And at the very end, it says this doesn't go into effect until the date it's stated. And then there's no date stated. It just seems shockingly incomplete.
You know, I can't speak for the infirmity of this agreement as you know it. It's hardly the hallmark of perfection. But it is the agreement that I have to advance before this court. It is an agreement that neither one of us wrote. And so we all go back and we look and we shake up the snow globe and then see what it looks like 14 years later. And we do know, that it was... When I say this, we do know. I'm referring to evidence admitted in the record, not just Mr. Magnuson speculating rankly in front of the Supreme Court. We do know that this was signed before June 7, and we know that it was June 7, 2008. We have no dispute that it was signed really in May of 2008. Again, not perfect, but we know that this was not viewed by all parties to this case other than the Capones as something that wasn't an agreement, because we know that the housing company went and bought the property after this agreement was signed in early June of 2008 based upon this agreement. We know that from the testimony by declaration of the president of the housing company, who testified that they were not going to buy the property in the absence of this agreement. We also know that the Urban Renewal District then went out and bought these four lots within 400 feet, and in the only addition in the northwest corner of Roosevelt and Ford, and we know that they completed them. So, yes, it's imperfect. We do know that the only person who hasn't done what they said they do are the Capones.
Is there workforce housing, though?
There's no workforce housing and no retail on the property. There's nothing on the property other than the same Idaho Youth Ranch building. Well, I think that's gone now, too. There's now the parking lot of the former Idaho Youth Ranch Park building because nothing can be proposed by way of a project. The Capone's remedy is that this agreement enforced in accordance with its terms without a specific project but with a use, workforce housing and retail development, is to ensure that the property is utilized by Midtown or whoever develops it, should this agreement be completed in a manner consistent with that.
So is your position that if the Capones were presented with an easement agreement designating parking on any of these four lots, that they would be required to sign that document? Or I guess actually that the city would be required to vacate the parking easement that's on the current property?
The Capones are entitled to relocate, they're obligated to relocate their parking easement to the four lots identified. The city's consent is not necessary to that, and that was a question I didn't get back to Chief Justice that you asked about why the city, the incompleteness, the city didn't sign it. And the city didn't sign it because the city, back to the parking. The Capones expanded. They needed additional parking to satisfy the city requirements. The Idaho Youth Ranch gave them the parking easement. That allowed them to satisfy it. The city said, you're not going to terminate this parking easement because it's necessary to meet city requirements.
Sir, I interrupt you over time, and I will allow you to answer directly the question asked about what the Capones would be required to do in the scenario.
Sure.
That's as well presented in the amendment.
Okay, the parking easement could not be terminated. It wasn't proposed to be terminated. That argument was advanced. It's not correct. It wasn't proposed to be terminated. It was proposed to be amended, which is the language of the agreement. The city has testified by declaration in summary judgment proceedings that it did not perceive its consent to be necessary to this. The housing company did as well because this was not a termination but a relocation of the easement rights in a manner that was acceptable to the city. Lastly, I say that the Capones introduced evidence that they are now in complete compliance with the city's parking requirement based upon parking added on site to the exclusion of this. So the city's signature was not necessary. It was deemed not necessary by both the city and the housing company.
One follow-up question. So basically, could Midtown exclude the Capones from using the Youth Ranch parking lot, the current Youth Ranch parking lot for parking, if they were presented with an easement on any one of these other four parcels?
I believe it's all four parcels, but could they preclude them from parking up? That was the expressed intention of the agreement, to free up the Midtown property so that it could be developed. So yes, that would be the result.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice Bettman. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Megan O'Dowd, and I represent the respondents, Tom and Teresa Capone, in this matter. I'll obviously take any direction from the justices on questions as presented. I would like to begin with the evidentiary issues. On review, I believe that's where the court is directed to begin. The standard for an evidentiary appeal is twofold. An appellant must show both an abuse of discretion by the trial court, as well as an injury to a substantial right. As well, any issue not raised in the appellant's opening brief is deemed waived on appeal. This court recently held in the Shepherd v. Shepherd case that the reviewing court would look only to the initial brief on appeal as to those issues presented, because those are the only ones to which the respondent may reply. Consequently, this court will not consider arguments raised for the first time in the appellant's reply brief. I would submit that it was the first time in the reply brief that we heard any arguments as to a substantial right being injured. There was no discussion of such an injury in the appellant's opening brief, having failed to do so, or even an articulation of an abuse of discretion standard. Having failed to do so, we would argue that these evidentiary objections have been waived by the appellant. I just want to briefly touch on two things. One, the admissibility of, even if this court were to consider these arguments that were raised in the reply briefing and deem that there was an abuse of discretion, there is other evidence in the record that supports the proposition that this contemplated development did not in fact occur. And I would direct the court to the supplemental declaration of Teresa Capone, which is dated December 6th. And I quote, she states that the proposed project was not supported by the Midtown community members and the housing company decided not to develop in the area. That undisputed testimony, coupled with the fact that we have in the record that the housing district obviously later conveyed the property to Midtown Development, demonstrates that, in fact, this contemplated development did not occur.
But what language in the agreement that we're talking about, the 2008 agreement, actually requires the completion of that project to put this agreement into effect?
Thank you, Your Honor. All of these issues were discussed with the appellant's oral argument, and so bear with me, but my review and interpretation is quite different. A few things. First, Mr. Magnuson pointed to the title of agreement for parking. I believe this court very recently, and forgive me, I don't know the entire name of the case, but it was the Treasure Valley Homes case. This court very recently determined there was an agreement to agree, and the parties in that case tried to argue, well, the reference to the fact that it's a contract in the document itself supports that this is more than just an agreement to agree, and this court refused to accept that argument. So that's the first point. Second, and I believe it was Justice Brody that recognized that, you know, there are very few actual terms that are in the binding portion of this agreement. And if we focus on binding term one, relocation of parking, we would submit that there are defined terms, right? It was agreed that a parking provision capitalized. So the court must actually look to the recital in order to fully understand what is contemplated in this binding term. So when we look at these, it is the agreement of the parking provision, which then we have to turn back to the recital. And where this 1999 parking easement is, and the contemplated development. And again, the development in recital paragraph 3, it is the Youth Ranch, LCDC, THC that are assembling property. So it's these three entities that are assembling property and preparing for development. And it is that particular development for workforce housing and retail, which will benefit all of the parties here too. So that's the stated consideration, this particular development. And then it is defined thereafter as the development. So it is this particular retail housing development project.
I'm sorry, walk me through where the development is defined.
It is in third whereas Youth Ranch, LCDC, and THC are assembling property and preparing for development, and that is the development. There's a very generalized reference to a location, but is this development defined, which is stated to benefit all of the parties here too, and then it's subsequently referenced as the development. So Andrews Ranch has requested Capone's to agree to the relocation of the parking provision to another area within the development. And then that's the conditional language.
That is to say, this easement, or, you know, that you agree to relocate this easement if and when this project is continued, or, you know, why is it continued upon this particular development?
We would submit that the stated consideration, so now therefore, a mutual consideration of the covenants contained herein, the consideration that was being offered and asked for the Capones to move and relocate their parking easement was for the development proposed by Youth Ranch, LCDC, and THC, which is stated in that third recital to contemplate the benefit to all parties. And even I would submit that even if it's not conditional, we believe it was, in fact, conditioned on this particular development coming to fruition. I mean, this court has also agreed, or has also articulated standards on agreements to agree. When a document is so vague that it cannot define material terms, then it is just an agreement to agree. Our review of this document is it's really like a non-binding letter of intent.
Would it be fair to look at it, because when I read it, it kind of read like a memorandum of understanding, MOU. This is what we hope to do.
Yeah, thank you, Justice Mueller. That's exactly how, and I think that the language itself absolutely supports that interpretation, because in this binding paragraph one, and it's already been discussed, but I think it's important. Again, LCDC intends to acquire certain property. THC intends to create the development. And the youth ranch intends to move to property within the development area. Those are all prospective conceptual ideas that potentially these five parties all agree to as a concept, but not enforceable terms by any means.
So, for example, the fact that THC intended to create, they weren't bound to create anything. LDC wasn't required to acquire the property, right?
Correct. Yeah, that's absolutely our intention or our interpretation of the agreement. And I think moving back to some of the recital language as well speaks to this, because everything is forward and prospective looking. And the case most recently that I was able to find about similar prospective language, bear with me. It's the Wallace v. Heath case, which I cited in my briefing, and that was a case. Different facts, but we had a realtor and a prospective client situation, and there was a text that said something like, please, if I decide to go this way, and the court said, well, that is both prospective and conditional. And I would submit that we have exactly similar language here, where we have intent in speaking specifically to where my clients were going to be asked to relocate their easement, is a mere expectation, are expected to be certain lots, which as Justice Jansen said, are not specifically described, and bracket, to be described further. That is a concept.
Well, but now that I think about this, that first sentence, it is agreed that the parking provision, which is the city requirements, I'm going to call it shorthand city requirements, will be relocated to property within 400 yards feet of Capone's property on the LCD property. So it will be relocated. And then we're going to have execution of more complete documents. In this, do we require the same level of specificity when it comes to property descriptions in this type of agreement that we would the actual easement agreement? So that is to say, can I agree with someone to create an easement agreement and not have meets and bounds description, for example, and have it be enforceable, or do I have to have the same level of specificity?
Thank you. I would submit that you absolutely do, particularly with something as specific as a real property interest. I mean, it must be described with particularity. And again, I think that this one sentence on relocation of parking has to be read in context, because while they may have agreed to the concept of relocating this parking provision, the parties, which would include my client, the Capones, will work toward execution of more complete documents. To me, that's like when we talk about drafting, I'm very glad and grateful that I did not draft this document, but when you endeavor, I have written in agreements, and they are generally non-binding MOUs, where we will endeavor to try. That is not a binding obligation. That just means, yeah, okay, we'll talk about it more, and we'll keep working towards something, but it's not going to bind my client to definitively move. And how could we be bound when there is no exact location? I mean, an easement is a real property interest that must be defined with particularity. And I'd like to speak to that for just a moment, because again, I think there are several fatal flaws with this. One, because it is defined as the new parking location, which is what is referenced in this binding term, again, the court must go back to the recital. It is merely an expectation, one, because it's only expected to be at this particular spot. There is a reference to blocks 5, 6, 20, and 21, block 6, addition to City of Coeur d'Alene. We have already stated that that is not an adequate legal description, and we can't use extrinsic evidence to support it. And even if the court could, it's fundamentally flawed because it represents...
Well, Kevin, you can hold on and have a third in the pause. I'm not sure what we have going on in the room next to us. I hate to have you try to talk over and us trying to focus. Since it's time to go, so let's try to see if we have any answer from our superior else. Just one moment.
Okay. Thank you. So I was saying that there's first a problem with the defined term of new parking location because it's recognized to be just an expectation. That's not an enforceable term. Two, it's not an adequate legal description and it can't be supplemented with extrinsic evidence because there's no cross-reference. And three, the lots that are recognized or that are referenced, even if the court were to look outside a document, are expected to be 5, 6, 20, and 21. Those are not even the lots that were ultimately purchased by Ignite Coeur d'Alene. It was 5, 6, 21, and 22. How could that not be a material term to my clients? I mean,
well, and let me step aside because as I'm understanding Justice Brody's question, which you can correct me if I'm wrong, separate and aside from an easement agreement that you can seek specific performance of, why isn't the first sentence of paragraph one an agreement that if you find me parking spots within 400 yards or feet, we'll step aside the yards or feet issue, if you find me those spots, I agree I will move where I park. And why can't you enforce that?
And I apologize if I didn't, I'm not intending to be evasive here, but I don't think that the term parking provision is a defined term that has to be inserted with the language from the third recital. And when you insert that defined term, there's no question in my mind that it's not a binding term because it's a mere expectation of relocating a parking right that my client had.
Parking provision is 12 spaces to meet city code. Right? I mean, if we're going to look at the recitals.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, correct. I referenced the wrong definition. It's to the new parking location. And that cannot be, and again, this is all essentially one very long sentence where the parking provision, and I apologize, the 1999 parking easement will be relocated, and we have another material term missing, is it yards or feet, 400 feet, to property on LTDC, Capone's property on LTDC property, and the parties will work towards execution of more complete documents evidencing the relocation as soon as possible once the new parking location is ready in accordance with the terms of the city. So again, and that would then reincorporate all of the kind of forward-looking perspective terms that are within the definition of new parking location from that third recital. And I would submit that when you incorporate these defined terms from the recital into the rest of the document, and then just looking at the document as a whole, I don't think that this court's precedent to date has seen such a document like this and enforced it when there are so many material terms. And again, I think the one most fundamental is, where would this parking even be relocated to? That is not a defined term. And that would certainly be material if the primary purpose from appellant's perspective is that the whole point of this document is to relocate my client's easement.
So, and I have a question about that, actually, because a lot of discussion about relocation of an easement, and I question, is this a relocation of an easement when we're talking about a different Serbian estate entirely and a different owner of the new Serbian estate? I mean, I struggle with that. Seems more like we're terminating an old easement and we've got to create a new easement. Can you speak to that?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. That is definitely an argument that has been raised multiple times below, and fundamentally, I think this entire premise is flawed because of that. The remedy that the appellants are seeking here is a relocation to encumber another property. We have no other party here that is willing and able and saying, oh yes, come encumber my property and here's the document to do that. That doesn't exist. There's no such document. I don't think this court, or frankly the district court, would have the power or authority to enforce that encumbrance. And there is information in the record where I think it's been phrased differently on appeal, but there is a letter in the record that was written by the managing member of Midtown Ventures to City of Coeur d'Alene. And in no undisputed terms, the intent was absolutely to terminate the easement. I mean, that request was made directly to the City of Coeur d'Alene. Please sign this document to terminate the easement. And there's another draft form in the record where my clients were submitted a termination agreement and asked again, terminate your easement parking rights, and they refused. There may have been some litigation strategy on why that request has changed, and I think it's because they think that the city then no longer would need to be a party, which is another fatal flaw, right? From our perspective, there are so many flaws in this document that render it unenforceable. Another which we haven't really discussed is that a named party, the City of Coeur d'Alene, never executed the document.
Well, why would they need to? I mean, this is an agreement creating, well, to your point, a new easement across property that the city has nothing to do with at the moment. So it seems to me that the only signature required by the city is the vacation of the original easement.
Well, that's interesting, and I'm not aware of a case, and I don't believe that they were invited to this court, where named parties to, I mean, certainly the parties contemplated that the city had a role in this because they were named as a party to the document.
That's a double-edged sword because they don't sign it. I mean, I agree with you that it looks like they set it up that the city's going to be part of it, but then the city never executes.
Which is my point exactly. I mean, another reason why it could not be an enforceable document, there's no mutual assent of all of the named parties.
What role would the city play in terms of, I mean...
They were named as a third-party beneficiary, or they were named as a...
To the original
19, which is certainly the backdrop of this document. I mean, they're wanting us to do something with the 1999 easement and then create a new easement. So that is why they were a party here, is because they were, if they want us to terminate the encumbrance on the subject property, the city had to be part of that.
So an unspecified inference can be made that they wouldn't object to changing the agreement that they were a third-party beneficiary to. But that would have to be inferred from the fact that the document is not attached to this. They were named the third-party beneficiary.
Right, I think that's a stretch that would be difficult for this court to make based on the record before it. I mean, I don't think we have any evidence in the record, and I mean, that would be like blue lining this contract to try to be something different, and I don't think the court has the authority under this setting to do so. And I would note that there is no severability clause in this contract. So you know, if the court were to say one piece were invalid, the remaining, I mean, the whole thing's valid. There's no severability clause that I saw.
Well, I don't understand what we would be blue lining.
Well, if Justice Mueller had raised the issue of could this court somehow, like, remove the name of the city of Coeur d'Alene from the agreement such that they weren't a party that was necessary to the agreement in some way. From my perspective, that would essentially be blue-lining them out of the agreement as a named party with a signature line. I mean, it was certainly contemplated by the original parties that the city of Coeur d'Alene was a named party and was going to sign this document and never did.
Well, the recitals reflect at least that the parties believed the city needed to approve the relocation to the new parking location, right? That's the next to last, whereas on the first page.
Correct, yeah.
So it would appear that's why the city was here.
Absolutely. They were a named party to the 1998 agreement, and their assent was necessary to this 2008 document. I'm running short on time, and if there are more questions on this issue, I'm happy to address them. I would like to briefly address the equity arguments. Those became new arguments on appeal and at reconsideration. 2 points, and these were couched in terms of standing, because the district court dismissed the complaint because, as we know, Midtown Ventures was not a main party to this 2008 agreement, and at the time of argument cross motions for summary judgment, had no assignment or privity to this contract.
But why wasn't Midtown successor to that agreement?
Well, the timing of that, I think, is very important. They were not in privity of contract, and that's the distinction that the district court made. They were a successor in title to property, but from a contract right, they had no privity to that agreement. They were not a named party, and when arguing before the district court at cross motions for summary judgment mid-December 2021, they were not an assignee either.
I'm not sure why they're not a successor is my question. The document, the 2008 document talks about a successor. Is Midtown a successor to the new French?
And I don't mean to repeat myself. I think there is a distinction. I think contractually, because we all are in agreement, this is not a recorded document, so it's not an appurtenance that runs with the land. So it's not something that can be a successor in title, that becomes a right as acquiring property as a successor in title. The argument that they posited is that they were a successor in interest to the contractual right held by the housing company. And that right did not exist until December
28, 2021. What you're saying is in order for them to succeed in interest, there would have needed to be an assignment.
Absolutely.
And there was one, it was just after the fact.
Right. And I think that's where, just to reiterate that standard for Rule 11.2b reconsideration, while a trial court is generally charged with taking on new evidence that would speak to the correctness of the order, that rule is not to be used as a way to evade due diligence and regular work. And that's really what happened here. I mean, a party is charged with having standing from the outset of filing a complaint and throughout the litigation. There was no contractual privity when they filed this lawsuit throughout all of the briefing, even through oral argument for cross motions for summary judgment. And frankly, it wasn't until the district court foreshadowed to counsel that they would be dismissed for lack of standing that they went out and acquired this contractual interest. And that type of due diligence,
I just don't understand why that isn't sufficient. I mean, standing is about people being in a position to fully litigate the matter. And it seems to me that Midtown was fully invested in this process. And what ended up happening was they dotted an I and crossed a T. Granted, it was after the fact, but that's what standing is all about. I mean, it's just about are you sufficiently prepared to litigate this matter completely?
Well, so and I may not be understanding the question fully, but if the question is whether they acquired, I mean, it's an abuse of discretion standard for the district court to not consider evidence on request for consideration, reconsideration. I would submit that having fully recognized that abuse of discretion standard and acting within the scope, I mean, they cited this to the Ciccarello case and the Summerfield case, which is what sets the standard for the district court to rule and say, hey, I think you're using this this new assignment inappropriately, having acquired it after the fact, and I'm not going to consider it at this time.
And my problem is, it seems to me that the legal effect, it seems to me that the district court was ruling that the legal effect of that after-the-fact assignment was more than it is. I mean, to me, to my mindset, especially when it goes just to the issue of standing, the fact that it was acquired afterwards means nothing.
Well, again, I to the best that I, and I hope that I understand the question, I think the important distinction, again, is what rights do people acquire by purchasing property? Certainly, when I am a successor entitled to property, I take all appurtenances that go and run with the land. Those would be of record interest. And then over here, we have those set of arguments where non-of record interest, which are the equitable servitude, potentially could flow to successor buyers, but that's an equitable claim. So from a legal perspective, as a successor entitled, I do not acquire contractual rights that are not of record and appurtenances that run with the land. There is no language in this document that says it's an appurtenant right that runs with the land. It was not recorded. So there's really no argument here that I'm aware of from appellant that this is an appurtenant right as a successor entitled. So from our perspective, when Midtown Ventures purchased the subject property, they acquired nothing other than a property that was encumbered by the 1999 Parkland movement and knowledge that the Capones were continuing to use that parking, right, and had signed this 2008 agreement. I mean, from our perspective, that is exactly why they are not good faith buyers and are not entitled to the equitable relief that they're asking for under equitable servitude and voluntary estoppel.
There was never an amended complaint filed asserting equitable claims here, correct?
Correct.
Nor was it ever pled that they were a successor. The three claims were breach of contract, specific performance of the contract, and declaratory judgment about the contract. I saw nothing in the pleadings about equity. And then on reconsideration, it was brought up, did you object to this being outside the pleadings, that equitable relief is not anywhere fled? Apart, I mean, I get the Ciccarone and all those holdings and what they say, but I'm just going back to the original cause of action. It was a enforces this valid contract cause of action, and now here we are down the road into equity on a reconsideration motion that I don't see was ever fled.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. And we absolutely objected to the new equitable claim, and I think there was a lot of discussion of that in the transcripts from that reconsideration hearing itself, where, in effect, I'll probably misquote the trial court, but I think he said something along the lines of, you know, we're switching horses midstream. And that's exactly how we viewed it as well. I mean, the theories all changed after we had already argued and been decided on summary judgment, and it became kind of an entirely new case on reconsideration.
Isn't there a difference on how we should look at these issues on reconsideration between standing and an issue on the merits? It's one thing to say this was well, it's a contract case, and now it's being changed on reconsideration to an equity case. But on the standing issue, there was an assignment that wasn't made that affected standing. Before the decision actually came out stating that, it looks like an assignment wasn't made. That kind of procedural irregularity, I'm just wondering if the same abuse of discretion standard would look at fixing the assignment issue in the same way as changing the complete argument. It would seem to me, anyway, on standing, there should be a little more leniency granted, perhaps on reconsideration, than perhaps on a new argument asserted for the first time in reconsideration.
So that's an interesting question. I don't know that I have that exact answer if there is an existing standard, so I apologize to the court once I'm not aware of it. But I would submit that, again, that I think it is incumbent on parties before entering into litigation and to have done their due diligence and to prepare, and I think that Ciccarello case did give the trial court the discretion, It did not specify, well, some evidence you can consider under abuse of discretion and some cannot be. It said, well, at reconsideration, new evidence is subject to an abuse of discretion. I don't see why this evidence should be treated any differently, particularly when it's something as fundamental as, do you have the right to even bring this lawsuit? And to have not figured that out until after oral argument on summary judgment and trying to fix it ex post facto seems inappropriate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, each of you, thank you. This matter is now under advisement. We'll be in recess until approximately 5 o'clock.
All rise, please.